I'm sitting with Jitendra Verma, the artistic director of Tara Arts, the foremost Asian theatre company in Britain, a theatre company that's now been in existence for 30 years. There are many things leading out from that fact, but the most immediate reason why I'm sitting with him is that there is a new production by Tara of Beaumarchais' The Marriage of Figaro, which has been translated by, or adapted by, Ranjit Bolt, opening at the New Players in London for a run of 3 weeks, I think, and then moving outwards or around and about the country. So it's going to be a busy autumn for Tara. Jitendra Verma, thank you very much for talking to me. Could you explain what's very intriguing, as in the past with some of your classic stage revivals, there's been a very interesting transposition here. Do you want to explain what's happened and why?
Sure. I mean, the thing that we, what we decided on was to transpose the play to 18th century North India. And that, for me, was because I felt that that was a very close echo to the background of Beaumarchais' own play, which is set about 20 years before the French Revolution, and clearly signals a society in transition away from feudal values and certainly feudal modes of behavior, particularly with the sexes, towards a more modern, a more egalitarian sense. And I felt that 18th century India was going through a similar moment of transition. The Mughal Empire was on its knees, really, and the British were just about to take over. And with the arrival of the British, India does emerge into a modern set sense of relationship, particularly between the sexes and the classes.
And can you possibly explain how does that, in a sense, what you've identified then is a big historical moment, how much of that is acknowledged in Beaumarchais' actual text? And because, of course, he was up against a huge amount of censorship, so your reading, in a sense, involves a bit more of a kind of proactive discussion of these political questions, I imagine. Is that right?
Yes, it does. I mean, I have to admit that Beaumarchais' text, it's interesting that you get these sorts of what I would call glimmers of the society he's talking about and the kinds of attitudes of the society, but you don't get a stark gaze at it. And so, if you like, the comedy, and certainly the farce, of which I think he was the originator, is very much at the forefront. And I felt with Ranjit that actually we should try and retain the same sort of vein. In our version, the Nawab, the Count, is sort of caught in terms of status between what he has an instinct of, which is the aristocratic privileges that he had, and the desire to be modern, which is to be British, to want to go to London, to achieve all of that brings with it. And actually what happens in the play is that he's constantly betrayed by his desires. His desires are really the old rooted ones, rather than any sense of wanting to be a new man. And it is very much in Figaro, and I think actually interestingly it's in the character of Roxana, or Susanna, that curiously we see more of a drive towards a modern sense of a relationship between the sexes and certainly between the classes.
And how do you, I mean, very intrigued by the idea that there was also a kind of parallel or a correlative Indian popular form to commedia dell'arte at the time. So in a way, there's a very great ease of matching going on in terms of the traditions. Could you just explain a little bit about the kind of popular Indian form that you've chosen, or maybe it chose itself?
Yeah. One of the things that's very little known or appreciated in the West is that Indian theatre is as varied as any other theatre around the world. And in India, what we see here in the West is much more of a sense of the classical theatre, the Kathakalis, the Kudiyattams, and so forth. But actually, there's a much more vibrant tradition, and that's what's now called the popular theatre. And in each region of the country, it took on a particular kind of characteristic. But they all share certain things. And one of those, for example, is the character of the fool, the equivalent in commedia of Arlecchino. And the other aspect that they share across all the regions of India is the sense that essentially it's a company of actors who are improvising around a basic plot. And therefore they are able to traffic quite easily between very contemporary accounts or very contemporary comments and whatever story it is that they're telling. And I found, felt that for us it would be appropriate to plumb what I consider to be a very close equivalent to Comedia, which is Bhavai of Gujarat in Western India. And that has the same sort of irreverent spirit within it. But the thing about Indian popular theatre, and this is what it shares with classical theatre, is that in Indian theatre, music and movement are as much text as is the spoken word. And I felt that that was very important in our rendering of this play. And so I have a live musician, and in some ways it could be said that he conducts the play. And that became my kind of homage to the history of Marriage of Figaro, which of course, as we all know, is, you know, known as Mozart's fantastic opera. Now, without going so far as to say that I have a Mozart on stage, I think my idea was very much to have this musician quite visible on the stage and to effectively dictate the rhythm through the thing. So I've actually relied a lot on percussion. Curiously, see, one of the things is that once you start making the kind of transpositions, and particularly when I started working on the Bhavai form, I realized that actually there is a kind of, if you like, the Indian version of stylization. And that works just as well. And that as soon as you start working with movement and with music, to an extent you are choreographing. And that's actually very close to Beaumarchais' text. It's very closely choreographed, you know, particularly all the kind of entrances in and out of doors. Now, we have tried to retain that quality and yet marry it to a much more sort of freewheeling sense that emerges, or a freewheeling spirit that emerges with Bhavai.
And is that a well-known discipline? I mean, is it something that actors would be able to steep themselves in fairly quickly if you ask them, you know, if you said this is the approach we're taking? Or do you have to do a lot of research and a lot of training?
There is a lot of research and a lot of training. One of the things that I find, of course, is that we as Tara exist along the kind of fault lines, if you like, of various cultures. And I don't have the recourse here to actors who are steeped in, if you like, in non-European traditions. I do, however, have recourse to actors who have a desire to explore other ways of doing theatre. And equally, I do have recourse to specialists, whether they be in Commedia, in Masque, in Movement, and so forth. And so part of the exercise in terms of this plan, indeed of other productions, has been to, if you like, to reinvent a style through translation. So, in Figaro, for example, a lot of work was done with Commedia specialists. At the same time, as we had a lot of literature and photographic evidence, and of course through the musician, a lot of kind of musical evidence of the way in which the Bhavai would be in India. And so it's really kind of marrying those two approaches to create a style that will fit this particular production.
And do you, I mean, it's sort of interesting to know, I mean, I don't know whether you get the opportunity to go to India to see what might be my populist theatre there now. But I mean, is it something that if one went and explored, one would find, or is it very much, as it were, in a sense, a kind of period or a museum form? I don't know what.
Not at all. You see, popular theatre in India is very alive and very well. But the question as to finding it is an interesting one. I mean, if one goes to villages at particular times of the years, for example, one goes to Gujarat, you will see Bhavai. In the cities, however, what one tends to happen is that, for example, the Bhavai, there is still a troupe of Bhavaiyars. And this troupe kind of dates back to the 15th century, which is when Bhavai was established. So if you like, it's been kept in the family, and therefore it's progressively down the centuries, it's become a particular caste of performers. And they tend to migrate to Bombay and some of the other kind of metropolitan cities in the off-season to play to particular community audiences. But then if one looks at modern theatre work in India, which I think is the closest equivalent for us, it's very, very interesting that the performers are trying, in Indian terms, to do the same thing as we are, which is to marry a modern sense of dramaturgy with the sorts of indigenous sources of theatre, in terms of ways of making theatre, that they can tap into, like Bhavai, like on the classical end, Kathakali. And so what emerges is a very eclectic modern urban style of theatre. And to me, that's like the truth of the modern experience, that we are, wherever we are extremely eclectic beings. I think, short of actually joining a traditional troupe, none of us in modern theatre or very, very, very few of us, is actively engaged in one particular style. Now, that has its drawbacks, but it also has its great advantages in that, you know, one's got a whole range of texts to choose from.
It's interesting, isn't it, that I suppose looking back over the works that you've been associated with, Atara, Pali, one thinks of Molière, also Gogol, it's the European, continental European works that seem to be the ones that this approach has most allied itself to. I mean, I don't know whether you've ever thought, oh yes, well, importance of being earnest, we could do that. Do you think it's a non-Anglo tradition in a way that most arises?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that's just been more an accident rather than a conscious thing. Partly, I suppose the only thing conscious has been that I've been aware that my ultimate is to dialogue with England. And so, you know, of late I've been looking at Shakespeare as well. And in fact, next year I'll be doing The Tempest. But the English comedy of manners has been something that I've sort of stayed away from. And part of it was simply because I think that I know that with the European work, to an extent, I already have the license because I'm going to translate. And as the moment you translate something, you are taking it out of its cultural context. I think whatever you do, you can never do a faithful translation, if you like. But with Sheridan or a Wilde, what is the translation? You know, I'll be doing it in English. So how do I approach that? And for me, if you like, the kind of European work has been a prelude to seeing, well, how will I approach an English text, a kind of purely English text. So one of the ones I've got in mind is Shaw's Pygmalion. And the thing that strikes me about that one is that it's so much about the teaching of English. And if I look at the modern call center phenomenon and so forth, so I'm beginning to get those sorts of ideas in terms of interpretation of it. But I think that that'll be more an interpretation exercise rather than a translation exercise.
I suppose it's curious to think that your company has partly made its name through these approaches to other texts. We're talking of, I suppose, hybridity, the way in which, in a way, as you say, we're all not quite belonging to any particular one thing anymore. As that has become more entrenched, I think, socially, there's been a kind of concomitant searching for the authentic, as though there is such a thing. And it seems as though you're damned these days almost for being, you know, since for searching for these kind of meeting points rather than from coming at things from one particular so-called authentic position. I mean, do you think that Tara is in some ways a victim of its open-mindedness, in that some would wish you concentrated on whatever, as an Asian theatre company, whatever the Asian theatre of this country might be, I suppose?
Absolutely, and that's something that I've resisted all my life and hopefully will continue to resist. Because I firmly believe, and it's partly to do with the accident of myself, that there is no such thing as authenticity. You know, we often come across in the theatre the cliché, just do the text as written. Well, what does that mean? You know, the text as written is a one-dimensional affair. It's written down on a piece of paper. But you're going to translate it to a three-dimensional space with human bodies. I just don't know what in that sense, what doing the text means. Because you will choose particular actors, you will choose a particular space, you will create a particular world, all of which will offer up signals to your audience. And depending upon who they are, they will find different sorts of meanings on that. So I think that for me, authenticity has never been a dream, never been an ambition, and quite frankly, it's a complete lie. There's a second aspect, however, and that is to do with the classics. And I think that there is a pressure, and I felt it over the years, with a company such as this, to if you like, do the new work. And often enough, that's meant, you know, the non-classics. Something raw, something edgy, and so on and so forth. No, I have nothing against raw and edgy and all the rest of it. But I do have something against this insidious implication that the classics are not for Asians. That, you know, it's best we just concentrate on what's going on in Bradford. Now, this is something that I thought about when I was doing Merchant of Venice last year. Initially, I had the thought that I'll set it in Bradford, in contemporary Bradford. And then I realized that that would be a reductive reading. Why keep it that close? We know what it's about. The text speaks. The fact that I'm doing it. And I then chose that, okay, rather than 16th century London, which is its original setting, I'll use 16th century Kerala, because there the same question of Christians and Jews was very rife. But once again, that I will let the text speak. And that's really what occurred. And it seems to me that one of the dangers that Asian theatre faces is to be too reductively of the here and now. Whereas I think that we need to possess theatre in its entirety. And for me, one of the most exciting things has been that over the past 30 years, I've seen many other companies come about. And as a result, I think that there's a much greater... Well, it's possible now to say that one can look at a much greater range of Asian theatre work, from the classics to new work. And I think that that's A, very, very healthy, and B, and this gets to the main point. For many years I've felt that Asian theatre as a kind of phenomenon, or British Asian theatre as a phenomenon, is much more of a sociological and a political phenomenon than it is an aesthetic one. And I have felt that if it isn't an aesthetic, if it doesn't become an art form, that will disappear, along with other things that disappear when politics changes. And I firmly believe that if it is going to become an art form, then we have to grapple with the classics in order to consider ways of performing kinds of dramaturgy that could emerge, that articulate, if you like, this sense of hybridity that we are all living in.
I wonder whether you could just explain a little, talk a little bit about your personal background, because it seems to me that's one of the great shaping influences as to why, as you said, you would be more inclined to look at where you've come from as much as where you're going to in a piece.
Absolutely. I mean, my parents were Indian parents who came to East Africa really to build the railway, which opened up East Africa. So the East African experience is only about two generations. But what's very essential about that East African experience is that already for us, the third generation that grew up in East Africa, India was in the imagination. It was an imaginative country. In some sort of a dialogue with the real country that we were living in, which was Kenya. Then in the transportation to here in 68, for me, I think that that process of a country of the imagination simply got accelerated. Now I was living in England, this was the country of my experience. This was the country which in many ways made me. But I also had other languages, other memories of other countries, and certainly other emotions which could be tracked down to or back to India. And to me, that became the most sort of fascinating project, that in contemporary Britain, this is the site of three, of the meeting of, if you like, three cultures, Asian, African, and European. And that really was the excitement. And in a way, that conditioned, I suppose, my sort of inauthentic approach to texts. I think over the years, I have learned to really respect texts and love them for what they are. I mean, I'm thinking here of about 10 years ago, I did Troilus and Cressida. And my approach to Shakespeare at the time was much more cavalier than it was when I did Merchant of Venice. And it was almost as if I was sort of skirting around this play. I thought the story was fascinating. I thought the story was very applicable to the sort of changing face of Europe that we were witnessing. This was sort of around the time of the Yugoslav War. But I don't think I actually engaged with the text itself. And what I mean by that was the structure of the text itself. This time with Merchant of Venice, I set out to engage with the structure of the text. What is the structure of that verse? How is it that the verse enables the characters to emerge? And I found that to be fascinating. And one of the things that really sort of startled me was that in many ways, when one approaches the structure of Shakespeare, the verse at times has got the same properties as a mask. I mean, this is from the acting point of view. That for the actor, the challenge is to fit the mask. In Shakespeare, the challenge is to fit the verse. And I thought that was fascinating, really fascinating. So, I think that I've begun to also appreciate the text and appreciate how through the text itself, and often enough sometimes through the structure of the text, I can see inroads into other connectivities, you know, to connecting up with other cultures. So, for example, with the Beaumarchais, the thing that struck me fairly early on in rehearsals was that while Beaumarchais had, was sort of very anal, I think to some extent his stage directions are more anal than Beckett's, you know, really. Every little thing is given a direction, and he had used all these doors and so forth. But actually, examining the text operates in many instances rather like doors opening and closing. And I thought that was really fascinating. And for me, that immediately began to ring bells with Bhavai, the folk form that I was talking of earlier, where the way in which the rhythm, and in Indian music, rhythmic cycles are very, very important. And basically, everyone is striving for the sum, which means both the culmination of a cycle and the beginning of the next cycle. And it's a fantastic moment when the music, the text, the movement all come together, bang, at the same moment. And it seemed to me that that was a sensibility that was very similar to doors opening and closing. So that became then my road into, if you like, the other culture, to looking at Bhavai and the kind of world that I was going to create.